Sabrina, for the invitation to speak. It's a real pleasure to be able to tell you about some recent work with Leonardo Di Gioia. So I've been working on celestial amplitudes and celestial holography more generally. And so the question, the broad question we're trying to address is essentially what good observables are in our universe. And of course, this is a very rich and hard problem in general. And there's been many methods that have been developed over the years to address this question in various settings. Today, I will focus on a particular simple example in which we're going to try to answer this question in the case of a flat spacetime. So asymptotically, flat spacetimes are spacetimes with zero cosmological constant. And why is this a good approximation to our universe? Well, because we know that the accelerated expansion of our universe, which would drive this cosmological constant to be positive, is actually not observable on anything but cosmological timescales. So for all astrophysical processes in our universe, we can ignore this cosmological constant and try to ask questions about gravitational radiation, black holes, and so on and so forth. So we're going to be in a setting of that of general relativity, basically, where this cosmological constant is typically set to zero. So this is what I'm going to focus about today. And so we know that in this context, in gravity, good candidate observables are scattering amplitudes, at least at low energies. Again, over the years, we have learned many things about scattering amplitudes. And one of them is that one can use them, while they are intrinsically quantum objects, one can use them to extract classical observables from them. So such examples would be scattering angles in astrophysical scattering processes, or one can extract properties of the gravitational sources from the radiation, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, they're practical, they're calculable in perturbation theory, but even at the classical level, they are known to suffer from infrared divergences, and this is still a problem under debate. But more importantly, at very high energies, so for example, in the context where one can imagine gravity becoming important at a particle collider, so this would be in the limit in which the energy of the colliding particles would be so big that one can form a black hole, the scattering amplitudes sort of become ill-defined, or we don't know how to compute them anymore. So in this regime, we essentially lack any tools to calculate this precisely. Of course, one can say qualitative things about them, but nothing quantitative at the moment. Now, I'm not going to answer this question. This was just motivation. But nevertheless, I'm going to start trying to make some progress by asking some very simple questions. And the simplest question is, what are the symmetries of these objects, of these observables? So we know that at both low and high energies, symmetries should constrain these observables. And one simple example, one simple instance in which this happens is the case of are the soft theorems. So let's consider this collision of two black holes, which results in a collection of gravitational radiation, here represented by these yellow curvy lines. So how do you represent this in terms of a scattering amplitude? Well, we can approximate our two massive black holes as two massive particles of momenta p1 and p2. They merge, and they, in the final state, we're going to have another particle, massive particle of momentum p3, and a bunch of radiation. Okay, and now the idea is that such scattering amplitude, in a particular limit, namely in the limit in which the energy of the gravitational radiation is very small, factorizes. So if we regard this gravitational radiation as a collection of gravitons and take the energy of one of these gravitons, omega, to go to zero, we arrive at the same scattering amplitude without this graviton times this prefactor here. So the leading term in this expression is called the Weinberg soft factor, and it's been known for over 50 years now. It's universal, so it doesn't depend on the details of the theory, so in particular on what kind of matter gravity is coupled to. It has a universal pole in the limit as omega goes to zero, so it goes as 1 over omega. Excuse me. Sorry. More importantly, what's been realized recently is that, so far this doesn't seem to be related in any way to symmetries, but what was realized about 10 years ago now is that the leading soft theorem is in fact equivalent to a conservation law. So what conservation laws are we talking about? So these are conservation laws related to the asymptotic symmetries of asymptotically flat spacetimes. And the simplest class of such symmetries are so-called supertranslations. So these represent enhancements of the translational symmetry that is present in any Poincaré invariant theory to include these angle-dependent translations of the spheres at infinity. So physically speaking, the reason why you have such a symmetry in asymptotically flat spacetimes is the fact that if you think about observers here at infinity, they are unable to communicate and hence synchronize their clocks. And so one can understand this supertranslation symmetry as a consequence of this simple physical fact. And again, this has been known for many years now, but it also tells us, but it tells us that the symmetry group of four-dimensional asymptotically flat spacetimes is much larger than we originally anticipated, and in particular, it includes this infinite amount of symmetry. So why an infinity? Because these diffeomorphisms, they are labeled by a function. These large diffeomorphisms are labeled by a function on the sphere. And so one can expand these functions on the sphere in terms of spherical harmonics, so one needs an infinite number of coefficients to specify such a function. In that sense, the symmetry is infinite dimensional. How do we use the symmetry to arrive at the soft theorem? So the idea here is that the supertranslation vector fields that are associated with charges in the same way as in classical mechanics, symmetries are associated with charges. And these charges in gravity, they act on the classical phase space of the theory. And moreover, in particular, one can extend the symmetries to act at the past null boundary, scry minus, and the future null boundary of this asymptotically flat spacetime. And their conservation in time amounts to the statement that these charges at scry minus are equal to the charges at scry plus. And upon promoting this classical statement to a quantum statement, in the sense that one imposes that these charges commute with the S matrix in this way, one can rearrange this Ward identity into the soft graviton theorem. So the statement is the Ward identity associated to the supertranslation charges is equivalent to the soft graviton theorem. So schematically, this is represented here. It turns out that these charges that act as scry minus and scry plus, they decompose into two components. One of them turns out to correspond to an insertion of a soft graviton into the S matrix, while the other one gives rise to this soft factor times the amplitude without this soft insertion. And so this identity here diagrammatically is represented in this picture here as the soft theorem. So if one moves the term on the other side, you get the leading soft graviton. Oh, sorry, in multiplication by omega here essentially projects out the whole tower that the other terms that one would encounter on in this term in an expansion in omega. So okay, so this was a statement about the leading soft theorem, but actually one can generalize this to subleading orders. And in particular, the next interesting thing here is that the subleading soft graviton theorem. So while the leading soft factor, so here is an expression for it, depended only on the momenta of the other external particles, pi, and of course the momentum and polarization of the graviton, the subleading soft factor also depends on the angular momenta, ji, of the external particles. And so one may wonder whether this subleading soft theorem is also associated with a symmetry. And indeed, it's been shown that the subleading soft graviton theorem arises as a consequence of the conservation law for superrotations. So what are these superrotations? So just like the supertranslations, they are enhancements of the Lorentz symmetries in four-dimensional asymptotically flat spacetimes to a full Virasoro symmetry. So I'm going to elaborate on that in a moment, but at the, to see that this symmetry is infinite-dimensional, one can just notice that these vector fields are parametrized by these, instead of just functions on the sphere, by these vector fields, YA on the sphere, that turn out to obey a constraint that renders them to be conformal killing vectors on these celestial spheres at infinity. So, and one can continue expanding in powers of omega, and one arrives at the full tower of soft theorems that actually turns out to indicate that a much larger and interesting symmetry structure exists in just Einstein gravity. Okay, but the existence of this enhancement of Lorentz symmetry to Virasoro actually suggests that a holographic correspondence in four-dimensional asymptotically flat spacetimes may exist. And this holographic correspondence is of special kind. It's not the same as ADS-CFD, where a theory in D plus one dimensional negatively curved spacetimes is related to a conformal field theory in one dimension lower. But instead, it's a correspondence. It seems to be a holographic correspondence between a theory in four dimensions and a theory in two dimensions. So I'm going to explain that in a bit more detail in a moment. But the reason why the subleading soft graviton indicates that is that Lorentz symmetry in asymptotically flat spacetimes gets enhanced to an infinite dimensional symmetry in the same way as a global conformal symmetry in two dimensions gets enhanced to full Virasoro. So this is the first hint that some correspondence like this may be at play. Now, of course, we expect these symmetries to have implications for the organization of asymptotic data and observables in gravity. And this is what we're going to exploit in the rest of the talk.
So basic question.
Yes.
This enhancement is only the feature of Lorentzian signature, or?
This enhancement.
Euclidean
goal. You mean Euclidean spacetime? You want the spacetime to have?
Is it Lorentzian necessary feature here?
I'm a big. The causal structure of an Euclidean spacetime is a bit different, so I need.
So there's no
Yeah, in Euclid, yeah, it's harder to define. Yeah, exactly, the S matrix. The causal structure is different, right, in Euclidean signature. But you could imagine analytically continuing, I guess, these. This is a symmetry of the S matrix, so it's defined in 3,1 signature, but you can ask questions about 2,2, where amplitudes typically are defined for Euclidean signature is a bit. I mean, I don't know, maybe there is a way to understand it from the Euclidean path integral I haven't thought about. Maybe this is what you have in mind, but like I don't, I'm going to stick to 3,1 in the rest of the talk. Really.
Is this still always just classical? These are all h bar to zero results. Are these all h bar at zero results?
The h bar equal to zero. No, it's not.
It's all classical things.
No, you can actually include quantum effects, and this the leading soft theorem will be uncorrected by it's known to also not receive any loop corrections, but the subleading soft graviton theorem, for example, is known to receive one loop exact corrections.
There are results at zero, okay.
But there is a rich structure and many things are known about these, but at the moment I'm just, it's just motivation, so I'm not really gonna focus very much on this in the rest of the talk, but yes.
One more motivation. Way back at the beginning of all this stuff, people worried that the large unitarity did not survive. I'm sure you know the conversation. But where does that affect us? Here, supposing that Hawking was right and the that unitarity is lost and phase coherence is lost in the outgoing state? Where would you see us in these results?
I think here we're assuming that the bulk theory is unitary. So at the moment, I don't think we can see. I mean, you know, the scattering amplitudes will obey the optical theorems and so on and so forth. So we're not. I'm not sure what example you have in mind where unitarity is lost. You can, of course, consider, you know, this black hole evaporation process, but we don't know how to compute the scattering amplitudes in that case at the moment. So I'm not going to discuss that. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So is it known the form?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the statements about the symmetry algebras at the moment, they are mostly tree-level. There's been some recent works where higher derivative corrections and loop corrections have been included, although I'm not sure if in gravity. But the statements about these infinity, I mean, this whole tower of soft theorems, how they satisfy these W infinity algebras, at the moment they're at tree level, and there are some quantum deformations known of that algebra in some special cases, but not, I would say, not in general.
And they are not realized in a non-anomalous way.
Or something like this.
I mean, Alfredo had some paper yesterday. I don't know.
I would say that, like, even Andy's, like, or Kevin, like, that there are instances or theories where they survive the quantum level, but the same one that's saying that generally they're not going to be.
No, yes, there are instances where, yeah, like, for example, in self-dual gravity, I think it was shown that this is not corrected, that W infinity is not anomalous, but I'm not sure if it's, I mean, it hasn't been studied or like in all theories. And in particular, in gravity, pure gravity, we don't know.
Yeah. There was a paper last week by Roland, who's a postdoc here, had this related to this question.
Roland Davidson, who's a postdoc here, had a paper on this issue with David Skinner like 2 weeks ago.
So what is it doing?
Oh. It's not specifically, but it's not exactly addressing this question, but it's related. They study certain anomalies in cluster space, and they show they can miraculously be cancelled on your work for self-dual theories at level.
That's what, for which you do the algebra?
W infinity.
Okay. But that's a classical algebra, isn't it? For GR?
For the gauge theory, the algebra is corrected. People, I don't think it's been analyzed when it's corrected.
Yeah, no, in GR, yeah, we have not. It's just, yeah. Anyways, so any other questions? Anyway, so this just served as motivation to introduce, to reformulate the scattering problem in four-dimensional asymptotically fed spacetimes in terms of some problem on the celestial sphere. And the first step in achieving this is to take the usual asymptotic scattering states that are labeled by, typically in an n-point scattering amplitude, they're labeled by n on-shell momenta that can be parametrized in this way. So here omega is again the energy of the particle, and x hat is a unit normal vector to the sphere. And so typically these asymptotic momentum eigenstates are taken to be momentum eigenstates that diagonalize the momentum operator. So this is how one builds representations of the Poincaré group typically, and the scattering amplitudes compute overlaps between such asymptotic momentum eigenstates in the far past and the far future, where the particles are assumed to be non-interacting. Now one can equivalently ask the question, what happens if we instead take these asymptotic momentum eigenstates to diagonalize a different Poincaré generator, namely the boost generator towards the point, particular point on the celestial sphere. So if one does that, one arrives at a different set of asymptotic states, that are still, for in the case of massless particles, they are still labeled by a point on the celestial sphere. So this is just the statement that the momentum of the particle is labeled by two angles in space-time. But now we have traded the dependence on this energy omega by the dependence on this parameter delta, which is the eigenvalue under the action of the boost operator on the state. So this is a boost weight, if you want to call it, or a scaling dimension in the effective two-dimensional theory. And so evaluating the S matrix now with respect to these asymptotic boost eigenstates gives us a new object. Of course, it contains the same information as the momentum space scattering amplitude, but it rearranges it in a different way. And this new object is called a celestial amplitude. So one thing I wanted to say is that boost eigenstates now, instead of under general Lorentz transformations, they have this simple transformation rule, unlike the typical momentum eigenstates, for which the transformation properties under Lorentz group, under Lorentz symmetries, is more complicated. So now that we have this new set of objects, these celestial amplitudes, that effectively, again, they live on a two-dimensional sphere at infinity because they're labeled by operator insertions on the sphere of dimension delta, we have a problem that we can study with two-dimensional conformal field theory methods. So the take-home message here is that we just recast the scattering problem in four dimensions in terms of a problem in two dimensions that has conformal and, in fact, full Virasoro symmetry. So far, there has been some successes in, from the past 4 years, 5 years of this program. And this is just a list of the more basic, somewhat basic features, general universal features of these theories. So by construction, the resulting celestial amplitudes, so the resulting observables, they transform like correlation functions of primary operators in a two-dimensional conformal field theory. This follows from the transformation laws for the asymptotic boost eigenstates that I've written down before. We know that this two-dimensional theory has a stress tensor for bulk gravitational theories in four dimensions. And in particular, the stress tensor can be constructed from a particular subleading soft graviton mode. We also know that the universal soft and collinear factorization properties of amplitudes, they translate into symmetries and operator product expansions on the celestial sphere, at least at the leading orders. And moreover, so soft symmetries, and in particular, this whole tower of soft symmetries, so all terms in a Taylor expansion of the scattering amplitude as a function of this energy of the graviton one takes to be small, that tower at the classical level at least, and in some cases also at the quantum level, implies the existence of this higher spin symmetry, a classical higher spin symmetry called W1 plus infinity. Now, there's also been some studies of infrared divergences in gravity, and it's known that one can capture these infrared divergences through vertex operators in the celestial conformal field theory. And moreover, these are known to be related to a rich vacuum structure of such theories. So there is an infinite vacuum degeneracy in these theories, which one can, well, hope to understand better actually in the future. Therefore, there's also many questions that one can ask. And the an obvious question is that while in the bulk we do have unitarity, it's less obvious how this unitarity arises in this two-dimensional theory. And in particular, this is because the celestial conformal field theory, so this two-dimensional conformal field theory, through this, the soft theorem, through the tower of soft theorems, they allow for a tower of negative dimensional operators. So these are operators that seem to exist in the two-dimensional conformal field theory that don't obey the usual unitarity bounds for unitary two-dimensional conformal field theories. And this may or may not be a problem for trying to formulate a bootstrap problem in this two-dimensional setting. Now there's questions about, sorry, yes?
So yes? Negative boost rate. They have negative boost rate.
So yeah, that
you're just talking about.
There is a collection of soft operators. So the celestial, the operators on the celestial sphere that correspond to increasingly subleading soft gravitons in the bulk. So those guys have negative dimensions, negative integer dimensions. They are related to the generators of the symmetries of this W infinity symmetries by some transformation in the celestial conformal field theory. But in any case, they seem to be there. And I think at the moment, it's an open question to try to understand. I mean, yeah, those.
Very good. If they weren't there, the Mellon transformation would be not complete.
Sorry, what? What is?
If you didn't have to sum over the negative weight states, then you would have a problem with completeness, I would think.
Yeah. So this is the. Okay. It's known that states that lie on the so-called principal series, so of dimension that that is 1 plus I lambda for lambda a real number for massless particles, mm-hmm. that those form a complete basis. But we have all of these other operators that are obtained from these ones by either translations or by the action of these subleading soft, conformally soft theorems, and those will have dimensions that are going to be shifted off the principal series, and they should exist. They should be somehow in the spectrum. So it's like what the best complete set of states that characterizes the celestial conformal field theory is. It's still somewhat of an open question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
All these features, I mean, they have a break. Yeah, some of them are, you know, the unitary, and some of them are not unitary. You can still formulate unitarity, the bootstrap.
Yeah, I think there may be some connections, which yeah have not really been studied. The Taylor papers. I need to read that more carefully, but I'm not sure if they talk about Liouville theory. They talk about mini. Yeah, there are some things that I think resonate a little bit with Liouville theory, but there may be some connection there, which has not been, I think, exploited or like studied enough. Basically, that's all I can say. So anyway, so then there are these other questions regarding the central charge of the conformal field theory. There are questions related to these rich structures in scattering amplitudes that seem to be much richer than the properties of the usual correlation functions in two-dimensional conformal field theory, in particular related to multi-particle factorization and so on and so forth. Then, you know, one can ask questions about beyond tree level when you include mixed helicities and when you have like higher derivative corrections or loop corrections. And again, that has not really been studied very much so far. And then, of course, there is this question about how to use all of this to arrive at infrared finite observables that one can actually, you know, like see in real life. Okay. But, sorry. By mixed helicities here, okay, this is a little bit of a subtlety that is related to these OPEs. So the statement about the OPEs is that they can, you can write down an ansatz for an operator product expansion of, for example, of gluons or gravitons that then has to be constrained by these symmetries. And it turns out that the symmetries constrain either Poincaré, depending on how you do things, you can use symmetries to constrain some of these OPE coefficients. And the idea is that you can also arrive at the same constraints from imposing associativity of the OPE. But there seems to be some puzzle when you have associativity of OPEs involving mixed helicity gluons or gravitons, or similarly, when you try to constrain the same operator product expansion of, say, two positive helicity gravitons with both a positive and a negative helicity symmetry. So there seems to be some inconsistent relations that arise when you try to do so, when you try to kind of study associativity of various combinations of helicity gravitons, there seems to be a problem. So
does this mean that amplitudes with a given helicity configuration different QGIS configurations have different symmetries?
So the perspective that has been taken so far is that really the symmetry, one should regard the symmetry as not being associated with both the positive and the negative helicity sectors, but it just sort of like focus on one and the other one, like kind of say that it acts trivially on everything and then you don't have any inconsistency. But there is something, I think there is, it's not just a puzzle about, I think it's really a puzzle about associativity of the OP. And I think Kevin has had some paper where they noticed this at loop level as well, and they found a way to fix this issue. So
exactly, issues with double stop limits or the velocity.
It's related, in some sense, it's related to the fact, I think, really, that the soft and collinear limits don't commute to all orders and from an amplitude perspective.
To the way you factorize at the beginning, the assumptions you make actually begin and factorize this, and then
it could
have to go back because now you kind of have a mixture.
It could be related to the presence of infrared divergences that correct these, that kind of interfere with the factorization properties, and there may be a way in which one can maybe dress operators or define a new sort of operators that actually obey associative. Yeah, but the issue with the mixed helicity associativity violation, you kind of see at a tree level as well, so you don't even have to. If you go to subleading orders in the soft expansion, right, the associativity puzzles relate to the subleading, sub-subleading soft gravity gluon.
That's the problem. Like,
I think that's like. I know. I mean, that's okay. And then, but what is what is supposed to be the interpretation from the celestial CFT point of view, where hopefully we expect to have some structure that is like an OPE, right? I mean, you can say that, okay. Then you say that there is no OPE, but how do we, yeah. Anyways, this was the puzzle, sorry, I should have. But, okay, it's not really gonna, this was just to introduce people who are not familiar. I hope I'm not boring most of you here. But today this sort of brings us to the question I was trying to sort of address today, which is whether one can make contact between these ideas and the more established standard holographic correspondence that is between theory of gravity in now negatively curved spacetime and traditional unitary conformal field theory that lives on the boundary. And historically, there's been two main approaches that have been taken in this direction, in the sense that people have tried and in fact succeeded in relating correlation functions or observables in ADS to scattering amplitudes, so usual momentum scattering amplitudes in the bulk. And the two ways in which this happens, one of them relies on this HKLL construction that relates boundary operators in conventional conformal field theory to bulk fields in ADS. So there is a kernel involved, which in the flat space limit, so in the limit when the ADS radius r is taken to be large, reduces to something very simple, and moreover allows these operators to localize on a particular slice of the boundary CFT and identify these boundary states with bulk asymptotic scattering states labeled by these annihilation or creation operators, A, depending on whether we look at scry minus or scry plus. So this is one approach. And then there's been another approach, naively unrelated, where instead a correlation function in the boundary conformal field theory is traded for a dual object, which is also called a Mellin amplitude, but in a very different kind of amplitude to the usual celestial amplitudes. So this is a Mellin transform with respect to the conformal invariants that parametrize a generic endpoint correlator in a traditional conformal field theory. And it was observed many years ago that these dual objects M, they share many properties with, in fact, they reduce to bulk scattering amplitudes in flat space in the limit when these Mellin dimensions delta are taken to be large. And the ADS radius also is taken to be large. So these have been approaches in trying to relate observables in ADS to flat space scattering amplitudes. But now that we have a new kind of observable in flat space, namely the celestial amplitudes, one could ask the question of whether there is a relationship between, a more direct perhaps, a relationship between ADS observables and celestial amplitudes. Why would we expect this to be the case? Well, because celestial amplitudes by construction, they already transform nicely as correlation functions of primary operators in a conformal field theory, so one may think it's natural that perhaps these celestial amplitudes will arise in some limit of ADS CFT. And indeed, this is what I'm going to show. So in the first part of the rest of the talk, I'm going to show that celestial CFT D minus one amplitudes can be directly obtained from a flat space limit of ADS D plus one Witten diagrams. And we're going to see that this limit is very simple. And then I'm going to illustrate this general construction with two examples. So namely the scattering of a, or rather propagation of a particle in a shockwave background, and the related example of 2-2-2 scattering at high energy. Okay, so the first part is to show how these ADS observables are related to celestial observables, and to see that, let's define in a bit more detail how a celestial amplitude is constructed. So I'm going to focus on the scattering of massless scalars, where the asymptotic scattering states have to obey the massless wave equation. And the way in constructing asymptotic states that transform nicely under Lorentz symmetry is to impose that, first of all, these asymptotic particle states diagonalize this boost operator. So I should say that here, L minus 1, 0, and 1, and the bar Ls, they are just the SL2C generators. This first relation is saying that this wave function diagonalizes the boost operator, L plus L0. It also diagonalizes the rotation operator. So this is, we're focusing on massless particles, so this should be zero. We have these two relations, and in addition, one imposes this highest weight condition, that these wave functions are annihilated by L1 and L bar 1. And so this is a way to build representations of SL2C. So we have these wave functions that obey these two constraints, and these are called conformal primary wave functions. They are labeled by a scaling dimension delta, a point in the bulk x, a point on the boundary q hat, as well as eta, which is a sign that distinguishes between incoming and outgoing asymptotic particle states. And so once we have these conformal primary wave functions, one can construct celestial amplitudes by integrating amputated time order correlation functions, as you would find in QFT textbook, against these conformal primary wave functions. So this is to be contrasted with the usual way in which one constructs momentum space scattering amplitudes by integrating the same object C against plane waves, right? Which is an alternate set of solutions that doesn't satisfy the set of conditions, but still to the massless wave equation. Now, how is this definition related to the Mellin transform I presented before? Well, it's quite simple. So again, here is the usual definition of the scattering amplitude. And the point is that once one takes a Mellin transform with respect to the energy of the external particles, these conformal primary wave functions that one can construct independently that I showed before can also be directly obtained as Mellin transforms of plane waves. So starting from the usual definition of a scattering amplitude, taking a Mellin transform leads to this definition I have written down before for a celestial amplitude.
Are there some boxes in there? Or like, are you sucking out the refugees, or am I?
There's some boxes. This was important. Yeah, those are already, because this is why I think I was careful in saying that these are amputated bulk correlation functions.
Okay.
So actually, this is... if this is an amputating bulk correlation function, then this is the formula. You may be puzzled why this is D4 rather than an inner Klein-Gordon inner product.
Amputating position space is like about
It's essentially, we can discuss that later, but yeah, I see. Good question. But this formula actually accounts for that. So these two formulas, they are related by a Mellin transform, and this is the usual definition of a celestial amplitude. And it generalizes to both higher dimensions, so not just four space-time. So here I've been focusing on four space-time dimensions, but you can generalize it to higher dimensions, higher spin particles, as well as massive particles. But I'm going to focus on scalars for the rest of the talk, for simplicity. Okay, so how do we get to these objects from ADS observables? So to do that, let me first also review how one constructs Witten diagrams in ADS. So it's convenient to, one can do this in many ways, but one can regard ADS D plus one, so Lorentzian ADS D plus one, as embedded in Minkowski D plus two dimensional space, where we have these bold X points in ADS, parametrized by these big X points in this higher dimensional D plus one Minkowski spacetime subject to a constraint. And it's convenient to parametrize this embedded space coordinates big X in terms of a global ADS time and a global ADS radial coordinate rho, as well as some angles on the sphere parametrized by this vector omega. And so boundary points in ADS are obtained by pushing these bulk points to the boundary, so in particular by taking the limit when rho goes to pi over 2 of these x's, and they blow up in this limit, so one has to sort of subtract those divergences, sort of multiply away those divergences. And so we have, the take-home message is that we have some bulk points in ADSX, boundary points on the boundary CFTD P. And the scalar Witten diagram in terms of these variables is obtained by in a very similar way, actually, to this definition I showed before, by integrating bulk-to-bulk propagators, again, pi, so products of such propagators, pi, against bulk-to-boundary propagators, k, over the points at which the two join in the bulk. So in this example, we'd have just four external points, and we attach them. There is one internal bulk-to-bulk propagator, and one multiplies the corresponding propagators and integrates against these bulk points x and x bar. Okay, so this is how one constructs an ADS Witten diagram. And sorry, I should say here that there is this powerful ADS CFT correspondence that relates these ADS Witten diagrams to boundary correlation functions in a d-dimensional conformal field theory. Now, we'd want to take the flat space limit of these observables. And again, this is well known how to do. One trades this global ADS time tau and this global ADS radial coordinate rho for some time t and the radial coordinate r that one keeps fixed while taking the ADS radius r to infinity. So in this limit, the ADS metric reduces to the flat Minkowski metric in d plus one dimensions. And then the statement, and the take-home message maybe of this talk is that scalar ADS D plus one Witten diagrams with boundary operator insertions separated by a certain amount in global time, namely pi, reduce to celestial amplitudes at leading order as one takes the ADS radius to infinity, provided that these spheres on which the operator insertions will be located are antipodally related. So this is a direct correspondence between ADS scalar Witten diagrams and celestial amplitudes. So how do we see this? Well, if we start from, we can analyze all of the components of the ADS Witten diagrams independently. So for example, we can start with the bulk to boundary propagators, which in ADS take this form. And now we can use the parametrizations that I've written down before to rewrite this bulk-to-boundary propagator in this particular way. So here, all of the coordinates that have subscript p denote points on the boundary, while all of the coordinates that don't have the subscript denote points are associated with points in the bulk. And so upon writing that and taking the limit as the ADS radius r goes to infinity, and placing the boundary operator at a special, at special times tau p, in this case equal to minus or plus pi over 2. This leading term here goes away, and one arrives for tau p equal to pi over 2 at a formula for the bulk to boundary propagator that is essentially the same as the conformal primary wave functions, the wave function that I've written down before. And similarly, for taking tau p to be minus pi over 2, one arrives at this other formula, and these two formulas actually turn out to correspond precisely to outgoing and incoming conformal primary wave functions in flat space. So the message of this slide is that bulk to boundary propagators in ADS for this kinematical configuration of operators in the boundary reduce to conformal primary wave functions, either incoming or outgoing ones.
Okay, so I know this has to work out, but I guess the thing that confuses me is if it's still a continuous spectrum of fields in the bulk. And
yes.
At one point, I would have thought that somehow there's like a little window near the bulk.
Yes, there is a window. There is actually. No, actually, because here I should say this, is that you have the freedom of inserting the operators on the boundary in some small window around these times that scales as the inverse ADS radius. And actually, you can do this here, and what that will amount to is shifting the origin with respect to which the conformal primary wave function is defined. And so I'm happy to discuss that.
Yeah, so then just my own thing, I would have said, across these space and I have like my null boundary. And
yeah.
Operators on this three-dimensional boundary, the same way that I have a three-dimensional boundary for what you're doing in ADS. And so, whatever condition I have where I take the flat limit, I would still think that I'm putting, like, at least this, like, that I wouldn't just have like a continuum now of fields in the bulk instead, right? Like,
I don't have. So if you inserted them, if you inserted them on a boundary, so the picture is like this. Sorry, maybe I'm missing the question. And I apologize, I'm not sure if people on Zoom can see this. But the idea is that you have a window on the boundary, right?
Yeah. And if you draw a little causal diagram somewhere in the middle of it.
Yeah, so actually these intervals map to scry minus.
Yeah. So if I put a local operator
and
at a point
these
of scry
intervals,
minus, I would still think in that little causal diagram window, like I have one field corresponding to a scalar.
Yes.
And then the delta is just coming from dimensionally reducing that window down to a point. Versus for you, the delta is like a set of fields in the bulk of ADS.
Which delta? Sorry, what
like
is the delta?
Like, do you have a delta exchange for like that or diagram?
Here at the moment, I'm not even talking about this. These are just the external wave.
Sure, but like how many, like if I wanted a principal series spectrum, like how many bulk fields is that? Is that one bulk field or is it? That's the thing that
if you want the principal series. So, first of all, I should say that this is. Here I'm not really saying anything about the dimensions, so I think that is something we can discuss that perhaps after.
Yeah.
How to get the I agree that this is a question, but here I'm just showing at the level of these observables that in this flat space limit provided. So these deltas, it's a little bit unclear what will happen to them, but I'm regarding them is that deltas here are whatever they are in the unitary conformal field theory, but then to get a celestial amplitude, you should do some sort of analytic continuation in delta.
One's a Casimir of the isometries of ADS 4 and one is a Casimir vessel.
Yeah. These are different. I agree with that. Actually, that is also a question that, exactly. Yeah. To understand how those, I agree with that. In fact, we're working on this. Yeah.
The picture. So you start with ADS 4 CFT3.
Yes.
And then you turn that into Minkowski 4 CFT2. Is that the idea?
Yes.
So how do we get a 2E CFT?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was. So if you take the 3D CFT that lives on the boundary, you take a particular kinematic configuration of the operators on the boundary where they're just localized on two slices. So these are two-dimensional slices of a three-dimensional CFT. So it's three-dimensional CFT.
I imagine it's pretty unusual if you have a 2D CFT. It would be very unusual for it to live inside a three-dimensional, to actually extend to a three-dimensional CFT in this way. So it seems...
To extend?
I mean, because there's nothing stopping... Is there something stopping me moving the position of those operators?
No, but here the statement, I agree with you, but the statement is that, I mean, even in CFT, right, you can consider particular kinematic regimes. So this light cone, regge, whatever, kinematic configurations. So this I would regard it as a particular limit of a three-dimensional conformal field theory in which these three-dimensional CFT observables, so correlation functions, they start looking up to 1 over R corrections like celestial amplitudes. And the reason why it's a two-dimensional thing is because these we are pinning these operators to these particular slices.
What's we need to do that? Is that, or is that just a decision?
I mean, those points would be points where you have some sort of like causal like influence of what the...
Yeah, so for massless particles, this would be some sort of like, it would almost be like a high energy limit in which the massless particles that are localized, that are separated by pi on the boundary, they would create some bulk point singularity. They would meet in the bulk at some particular small region, which would be your flat space region. So for massless particles, I'd say that this is the picture, but for massive particles, one should still try to understand that.
But in Hijano's picture, so he would also put things in the boundary experiment. Like, would he, I still think he would say that, that there's only one bulk field corresponding to the scalar, like.
Yes.
And so then how?
But I don't understand. Here it's still one bulk field, right? A particular boundary operator of fixed dimension delta will correspond to a celestial operator.
I want one bulk field for continuum of delta.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I need to think about that.
I mean, like, say this works out, then it seems interesting because there'd be two bulk, like, there'd be two ADS series. Like, there'd be one with this continuous, like, set of fields with dimensions near zero, I guess, whatever, how you're scaling it, and one with this one field. Like,
so, I'm still trying to understand. So, with Leonardo, we're trying to understand actually the representation theory now of just purely three-dimensional conformal field theory when you do this restriction.
Yeah.
And it turns out, at least as we see at the moment, that actually you do get these symmetries when you do this restriction. Okay, yeah. Like infinite dimensional symmetries, and we're still trying to understand exactly what the precise relationship is between deltas in the CFT and the deltas for the celestial amplitudes. That I agree with you that they're diagonalized different generators.
Yeah. So like we should talk later, but like Justin, the approach that we're taking is that we're like comparing Poincaré primary conditions to like 3D or primary, and it's basically an ISO 2 that you have to get rid of the continuous generators, but it's basically the same thing. So like in that situation, you think that really okay, I have a 3D CFT and it's Carolian theory, and not that it's a.
But the Carolian theory would still be so here it's. Anyways, so this doesn't give you the Carolian theory, it just gives you directly the celestial conformal field theory. It's like already integrating over your null directions.
Which is weird, right? Because you're doing that instead of with like a...
That's, maybe we can talk about that later. Yes.
Massive regression?
Yes.
So, what can you say about this dimensionless constensor?
Sorry, what is the question?
So in the celestial CFT, there is supposed to be a stress tensor, right?
That is a great question. Actually, with Leonardo, we are working that out. So the way it works right now, well, we can maybe discuss this later. There seems to be some picture in which one has to consider particular, correlation functions of particular operators in this three-dimensional conformal field theory, and then take this flat space limit. And the stress tensor that is related to the subleading soft gravitons in the bulk arises from a particular operator in the CFT that is related to the stress tensor in the three-dimensional CFT in the flat space limit.
So in the 3D CFT, you're sending the central charge, some central charge to infinity, I assume, in the large limit.
Yeah, this is something that I'm a bit confused about. The central charge, I agree with you that in this large radius limit, it seems like C goes to infinity. And that's something that I don't know how to think about.
We need to be rescaled or?
I don't.
To Kevin's question, right? In the sense, it's curious to find the conservatory stress tensor inside a 3D CFT.
Yes, but when you do this restriction, okay, maybe you can discuss this later because I've been a bit puzzled by that as well, but I think, okay. When you do this restriction to a particular slice, there seems to be some like emergent symmetries that arise just from the usual conformal killing you know, equations in the three-dimensional CFT, they split into a collection of equations that have solutions, an infinite dimensional symmetry, basically, that includes the Virasoro, and for particularly CFT3, it doesn't work for any D-dimensional CFTs. For D-dimensional CFTs, you just get BMS. I mean, you just get BMS, you don't get Virasoro. Virasoro seems to be a special feature of the 3D to 2D restriction. This is also, it's work in progress, so it may be completely wrong. So I'm happy to chat further about it. But anyway, the claim is that there is a relationship between, we think that there is a relationship between the stress tensor in three dimensions and the stress tensor that appears, you know, as the generator of these subleading soft theorems in four dimensions. But it's work in progress, yes. Sorry, I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I do agree that it's a bit puzzling. I agree with that. Okay, so I think I'm almost out of time. So let me just conclude, sort of complete this picture. So one can do the same thing for the other components of the ADS width and diagrams. And so, for example, the defining equation for the bulk-to-bulk propagator in the flat space limit reduces to the defining equation for the propagator in flat space. And in particular, one can get either massive or massless exchanges, depending on whether one chooses to scale this dimension of the intermediate state with R or not. And the integral over these ADS bulk points reduces to an integral over flat space, again, to leading order in a 1 over R expansion. And so putting everything together, one finds this result that an ADS width and diagram for ADS D plus 1 for this particular kinematic configuration of operators on the boundary, and as one takes the limit of ADS radius going to infinity, reduces precisely to the definition of a celestial amplitude to leading order in a 1 over R expansion, where R is the ADS radius. So I'm exactly out of time at this point, and so I think I should skip through the applications, and here are the final sort of open questions. So thank you very much.
Any further questions?
Yes.
I have a question about the symmetry. So how do you see this emergence of this infinity?
Yeah, that's what this is what we're doing now, actually. So we can discuss that part. I mean, it's very simple, actually. So still checking it, but we can chat about it. You can see it from a purely boundary perspective without having to make any reference to the bulk, to boundary conditions in ADS or anything like this. Yeah. But we're still, I mean, it's confused. It's still a bit confusing, but yeah, it seems like it still survives the last 4 weeks. These equations we are, it seems to be there. I mean, yeah, in CFTD, when you do this restriction, I agree that there is no mechanism that would drive these operators to be localized on some particular slices, but you can nevertheless consider a kinematic configuration in which these operators are in those positions, and in this limit, these celestial amplitudes are emerging, and the symmetries seem to also be emerging. Yes.
The symmetries happen when your operator is, for example, holomorphic, like deep R below 0, so it's conserved and you get symmetries. So that's a really unusual thing in a 3D theory to have operators like that. So is there some mechanism to.
You're saying in two dimensions you have these for holomorphic. Yeah.
It seems weird to have that in a 3D CFT.
When you do this dimensional reduction, when you do this restriction of the conformal Killing equations, and you start expanding them in parts of 1 over the ADS radius, where you only localize your things on a particular time slice of width 1 over R, the conformal Killing equations split into a set of equations whose solutions include a Virasoro vector field. So I would say that this is how it arises. And they also include a BMS vector field, like a super translation vector field. It's weird. I mean, I'm not, but this construction is quite general, so the symmetries have to arise in this limit. So I'm puzzled by it because I haven't seen it before, but I don't know. On the other hand, this suggests that they should be there. So it seems like, yeah, we're seeing them, so, but still thinking about it. I agree. But it's strange. I don't know how to do that. I need to think, like, we can talk about it later. I don't know how to get W infinity. I have an idea how to get, perhaps how it would make sense to get the leading soft theorems from this picture, but the W infinity is very strange. Like, I don't know so what that would correspond.
Like, are those two different bulk fields? Are they one bulk field with a different way of limiting?
They arise from one bulk field. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Just a question. So, if you study the one of our corrections from the CCFT perspective, what does it look like? If you start on the S matrix and you ask what is the operator that they forms?
You mean the one over bigger? Yeah, I haven't. I don't even
know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't studied those. I don't know what they would mean also. It would be something beyond flat space.
Yeah,
I don't know if they have any meaning.
Yeah, what kind of operator is it in flat space?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question. I haven't had time to do all of them. Understand everything about it yet. But yeah.
So it's not something in W infinity because it's not subtle.
No. Yeah, it would be something.
I mean, perhaps as long as sending the central charge to infinity and rescale some components to the stress tensor to keep the correlation function of the stress tensor finite, it's possible that some part of the stress tensor, so maybe the conservation equation for the stress tensor gets truncated and only the 2D part remains. I mean, Kevin asking how you get an holomorphic stress tensor in a 3D theory, or an holomorphic operator at all. But perhaps in the large limit, you can treat different components of the stress tensor differently.
Yeah, I understand your question. But when you do this restriction, one, like the dependence on this radial direction in the CFT, 3 sort of drops out. And you just have an operator that depends on angular coordinates. I'm not sure. I still need, okay, that I have to work out more carefully. Let's put it this way. This was just a phenomenological thing about the limit, the flat space limit of ADS Witten diagrams, understanding exactly how this, like, 2D stress tensor arises. Of course, it's a different thing, and I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. And it may well be that what we have so far is wrong. I mean, this is why we have not. Yeah, we're still trying to understand how that appears.
Hey, let's think of it again.